Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Pluto TV is the new leading free streaming television service. You can watch over 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all for free. There's no credit card needed, no sign-up required. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies. Pluto TV is free on all of your favorite devices. Download Pluto TV today.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
I'll tell you what. The White House and myself and letters and emails and phone calls have received more phone calls than I think on any other subject of people from Baltimore and other cities corruptly run by Democrats thanking me for getting involved. Those people are living in hell in Baltimore. They're largely African-American. You have a large African-American population, and they really appreciate what I'm doing, and they've let me know it. They really appreciate it. By the way, the numbers just came out. Unemployment for African-Americans is the lowest it's been, the best numbers, meaning, in the history of our country, the lowest in the history of our country. But people have called from Baltimore thanking me so much because all that money that's been spent over 20 years has been stolen and wasted by people like Elijah Cummings.
All right. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast, and we have a lot on our plate. The Democrat debates. Oh, my goodness. I know you're all on the edge of your seat about that. But the claim of racism in response to criticism of declining urban areas in the United States. We've heard the claims of racism for years. They've been used as protective shields to protect legislators, local, state, national, political figures who are basically either out of ideas or are part of the corruption and the corrupt cycle themselves. And so we hear Trump's a racist, or this policy's a racist, or the police force is racist, even though during the Freddie Gray thing, you'll remember that 40% of the police were black. But it doesn't matter. It's just they think that is enough to end the conversation. Trump comes along and says, no, that doesn't work on me. It doesn't work on me. You could call me racist. I'm going to point out what you have not done for decades. And a friend of mine just reminded me, which I should have mentioned on the show last night, that Nancy Pelosi's father was the first in a long line of corrupt mayors in Baltimore. Nancy Pelosi's dad. Yeah. So we'll talk about that here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. Donald Trump spoke about this today. And of course, he's been taking a lot of incoming, and a lot of Republicans are concerned that suburban women are already fleeing Trump and they don't like this hot rhetoric. This is how we spoke.
Baltimore has been very badly mishandled for many years. As you know, Congressman Cummings has been there for a long time. He's had a very iron hand on it. It's a corrupt city. There's no question about it. All you have to do is look at the facts. The government has pumped in over the years billions and billions of dollars to no avail, to absolutely no avail. Baltimore is a is an example of what corrupt government leads to. Billions of dollars have been given, and I feel so sorry for the people of Baltimore. And if they ask me, we will get involved. We're already involved from the standpoint that over many years, billions and billions of dollars have been given to Baltimore. It's been misspent. It's been missing. It's been stolen with a lot of corrupt government. And as you know, Cummings has been in charge. Now, I will say this. I think that Representative Cummings should take his oversight committee and start doing oversight on Baltimore. He'd find out some real...
Well, I think Trump wants to make Baltimore great again. And there's no reason why these once great American cities can't go through their own reawakening and period of renewal. But not by doing the same thing they've been doing. And the corruption runs deep. This is not a money problem. This is a failed leadership problem and a corruption problem. Joining us now, Bob Woodson, an old friend. He is the president of the Woodson Center, has spent so much time devoting his life to helping those in need, especially in inner cities across the United States. And he joins us now. Bob, it's great to talk to you. Boy, you've been involved in cities like Baltimore for decades. What is Trump getting right? Is he getting anything in his approach wrong?
I think the content of what he's focusing on is accurate. But by attacking Cummings, it lets them off the hook, because then they can concentrate on his attacks on the man and without having to confront the corruption or the content of the issue. And that's what makes it difficult. It's interesting, Laura. If you look at a picture of, it's worth a thousand words. You look at a picture of Hiroshima after the war, and then juxtapose that with a picture of what Detroit looked like. And then today, if you look at the city of Hiroshima and you look at Detroit, it's just the opposite. Detroit looks like a bomb fell on it. After having liberal democratic rule and $22 trillion in poverty programs over the last 50 years, it's a wasteland. But I really think that what the Republicans need to do is focus on solutions. What is their solution to it? And I think Jack Kemp led the way in the mid-80s. What Jack did was look in these failed communities. There are always, someone said that the sickest part of the body draws the most active antibodies. And what we have done throughout the is go around these communities and look into, and there are always antibody groups of grassroots leaders who are what I call insurgents. They are fighting against the tide by creating areas of personal responsibility. What Jack Kemp did in the mid-80s was he came and spent a day with us listening to these resident leaders chronicle their success at driving the drug dealers out, promoting personal responsibility, creating islands of excellence in some of the most drug-infested, crime-ridden neighborhoods. But Jack led a group of Republican congressmen when Newt Gingrich, Dick Armey, and Steve Bartlett were freshmen. They held hearings in Kenilworth Parkside in the far northeast Washington, where resident leaders spent a day sharing with them their success at driving out the drug dealers and promoting economic development in there. And as a result, it was the lead story on all of the local television stations because it was so unusual. The Democrats were embarrassed, and therefore Henry Gonzalez had to have hearings 2 weeks later. Well, Jack continued, and he worked with us, and the resident leaders from around the country that came up with 7 amendments to the Housing Act. And Jack Kemp, led with this Republican group, said that we will promote these changes in the Housing Act that would empower residents, but we are in a minority. If you recruit 1 Democrat, we will give you 100 Republican votes. Walter Fauntroy stepped up, and he co-sponsored 7 amendments to the Housing Act in the 80s. And the Amoco company put in $1.9 million. The Bradley Foundation put some money in.
Yeah, but Bob, I know all this. I know all this, and I think a lot of our and it's great. Well, what happened?
What happened was the Housing Act was changed. We have 93-0 votes in the Senate because Bill Armstrong came together with Dick, the Republican in Illinois. In the House, we passed it 430-0, and Reagan signed it into law, flanked by myself and 6 resident leaders. And so here's an example of Republicans challenging Democrats on substance by promoting reforms from within the community suffering the problem. And I thought that was going to be the agenda that we would follow after that we need to come in and join with these insurgent groups.
Yeah, and decouple from the partisan politics, which is corrupt politics.
Exactly, decouple it, and then provide material support, but also policy support. And Jack Kemp, was defined, his whole career was defined like that. And when he became HUD secretary, when he got off the airplane going into these cities, he didn't go downtown. He went to public housing and invited these liberal mayors who never visited public housing.
What about the opportunity zones of Trump? This African-American pastor came on my show last night, and he kind of said, well, those are fine, but we need a lot more money. And our mutual friend Lee Habib just wrote a great piece for Newsweek saying, money? Baltimore has gotten billions and billions and billions of dollars. And as far as we can tell, they still have the second or third worst performing public schools in the country. And quality of life is third worst in the country, third most dangerous. So on and on.
Money is never a problem. Washington, D.C., at one point, Laura, led the nation in 18 separate categories of poverty expenditures, and they were 48th in outcomes for the kids in the schools. Mm-hmm. So money isn't a problem. But the Opportunity Zone offers a great opportunity. And again, there are examples of how a community can be revitalized without being gentrified. Pastor Buster Sorries in Somerset, New Jersey, under Governor Christy Todd Whitman, for 20 years has a national model for how you redevelop a high-crime, low-income neighborhood, and so that businesses are moving in and the community is prospering without gentrification. So again, this was done under Republican Christy Todd Whitman, and it serves. I send people from all over the country to Somerset, New Jersey, so that they can see firsthand what a revitalized community looks like without, in fact, any government funding coming in except through loan guarantees. But that's not, and so there are models, Laura, around the country, and opportunity zones would be perfect to augment a creative strategy. You first have to change the behavior of the people. If their attitudes and character are not changed, no amount of investment.
Well, that goes right to what I was going to ask next, which is we've had an erosion of fatherhood across every demographic group, Hispanic, white, black. Especially hard hit, it seems, is rural America.
Yes.
With opioid addiction, domestic abuse, and inner city America with the addition of drugs, gangs, and depression. There's a lot of kids. These kids are depressed, looking for some type of connection with a male role model. That's a deep problem. So what do we do about that?
Well, again, there are examples around the country where the community has taken charge, where young men who were predators through God's grace have become transformed and redeemed. And Las Vegas, Nevada is one example. My friend John Ponder has 2,000 people who, over the past 10 years, who've come out of prison and have changed their lives around. And they have become moral mentors and character coaches to others. And many of these men served as surrogate fathers to these inner city kids. We have examples of this happening right here in Washington, where a group of men have dedicated their lives to being surrogate fathers. And as a consequence, hundreds of kids are being remoralized by these urban heroes. But again, the qualities that make them effective makes them invisible, because they're not whining and complaining, they're not marching, they're not cussing anybody out, they're not playing the race card. But again, transformation of character has to precede economic development. You've got to change the attitude, values, and behavior of the people for opportunity to work. Changing the environment, investing in housing and schools does not work if you don't first change the attitude of the people. And there are examples around the country, Laura, that we have that I can take people to that shows you how they are able to engage in the transformation, the redemption of people.
We're talking to Bob Woodson, community leader and president of the Woodson Center. And Al Sharpton you know, enters the scene, injects himself into a controversy where he knows he can get a lot of publicity
and money. And money,
of course. He shows up, and it's such a, like, yesterday I was kind of depressed, Bob, because I feel like we've been having these same debates since, well, long before, since I was in law school, long before I was involved in the media, like in the 90s, the Crown Heights. I mean, it's just like this is the same familiar pattern and nothing changes. And so Al Sharpton comes on the scene and all the cable news shows, you know, follow him around. And I mean, like, what has he done for inner city America at all? What has he done ever?
But there are people around the country that we've identified who have counter voices to Al Sharpton, but they don't get the investment, Laura. The left has a ground game. They pay Al Sharpton. They promote. They put him on television. They all these race grievance merchants have access to microphones. They have book deals. We need to invest in different presenters. We need a different messenger. There are hundreds of low-income minority leaders around the country who believe in traditional values and are patriots, but they're not given the kind of investment that I really think that one needs. Dick Riordan in California back in 1990 is an example of how if a Republicans invest charitably, they can harvest politically. Well, Dick went in and started to work with low-income Hispanic leaders who were all Democrats, but he invested. He recruited his friends to meet real needs that people had. He built a first-class after-school facility there. And when he declared for the mayor's office, he was the first Republican in 35 years to win the mayor's office in Los Angeles. And then when he ran for re-election, he won by 60% of all major demographics. Again, because he was a conservative Republican who came in, invested, not just money, but he recruited people to help local people. And these local people are not necessarily represented by the political leadership. And that's why I really think that what we've got to do is have a strategy that goes around the mayor, goes around the civil rights, race grievance hustlers, and goes directly to these insurgent groups that are in these communities and provide the kind of support that Jack Kemp mobilized when he was in office. If we do that, Laura, we can win this fight.
Bob.
But we need a different messenger.
Mm-hmm. So
let the people suffering the problem speak for themselves, and then it undermines the moral authority that the Sharptons have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're kind of heavy-footed on, you know, the personal attacks. The heavy-footed as Trump did, and he was being attacked, I think, and he truly believes that it's an outrage that Baltimore and Detroit and St. Louis and L.A. and San Francisco. I mean, he was all over these places when he was a little kid too, with his father and grandfather. He truly is just outraged that the people of these communities haven't been able to take part in this growing economy the way they should. And he's just he wants to do something about it. I think, you know, his defense mechanism gets the best of him, and so he. You know, he hits back at Cummings, who's trashing him morning, noon, and night, and then they're off to the races. But people are talking about Baltimore. They weren't talking about it before, I can tell you that.
Yeah, but I hope that the rhetoric doesn't just stay at the personal, taking sides, either Cummings or the president, because the people suffering the problem don't benefit from that. But I really think this is an opportunity for conservatives to take a second look at what worked in the 70s, in the 80s, and begin to provide the means for the people to speak for themselves. Burgess Owens, Hall of Famer, played kind of, he is a powerful spokesperson for these kind of views. Burgess Owens needs to be on every television station in the country. And there are other leaders in these communities who have powerful testimonies of resilience, how they came out of these drug-infested, crime-ridden neighborhoods, and they have been prosperous. But again, we should let them challenge Cummings and the left and not have somebody else do it.
Yeah, and I think
nothing is more powerful to undermine the moral authority is when people who say they represent people and have those people speak up and say they do not represent me.
I agree. And I think that what the left is hoping to do, and you don't want Trump to help the left at what their ultimate goal is during the, during this period of time, is they want to make Trump so radioactive that he can't go into any of these places. Like he that anything he does in Chicago or Oakland or St. Louis is immediately called racist. And they did that during the campaign, as you remember, Bob. I mean, they threatened violence in Chicago. They had Trump ultimately canceled his appearance there. They committed violence in Oakland and San Jose. So they're threatening. They don't want the curtain pulled back on this these decades of failure.
But a significant number voted for him, though. And look at the Florida vote, Laura. Let's look at, again, a positive example. DeSantis won by 32,000 votes. 32,000. 100,000 of those votes came from low-income black parents. And remember, Gillum, the black Democrat, was supported by Oprah Winfrey and President Obama. And so 100,000 low-income black parents voted against Obama and Oprah in Florida because DeSantis supported choice in education. So those low-income parents put the substance of an issue before race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so you're saying we can build on that. You can build on that with the right message.
Yes, we can. Let me go just one other example. When we successfully fought the Second World War, part of our strategy was to support insurgents within Italy and in France. And those insurgents needed money. They needed communications equipment. They needed a lot of help from outside. Well, a lot of the grassroots groups that the Woodson Center has supported over the years have been attacked by the social welfare system, and it's $22 trillion it's spent, and also the race grievance industry has been like an occupying army. And these groups have been like insurgents, and we need to look at them as insurgents and treat them that way, invest in them, seek to a strategic alliance with them. When you seek a strategic alliance that takes race and takes everything else off the table, the interest of low-income people in those communities is compatible with what the Trump administration is advocating with opportunity zones, with the Second Chance Act, and other things like that. We should leave race aside and just objectively seek to treat these groups in the inner cities as insurgents, resource them with money, with training, with assistance, strengthen them, and then give them a platform to speak for themselves so that they challenge Elijah Cummings and Al Sharpton as opposed to people from outside who they can easily dismiss.
Right, and they can caricature. And I think looking back on the cities where things have really began to turn around, and like New York under Giuliani, I mean, you have to get tough on crime. I mean, you can't.
Right.
I mean, that Stephanie Rawlings Blake during the Freddie Gray riots.
I worked with the police and instructed them to do everything that they could to make sure that the protesters were able to exercise their right to free speech. We also gave those who wished to destroy space to do that as well.
And people don't realize, I had to make this point to a group, that I was living in New York in the 70s for 5 years when Nikki Barnes and Frank Lucas and the big drug kingpins when the community was awash in drug. It was the black community that demanded harsher sentences, sending a drug dealer in jail for life. That came, Rockefeller law came as a result in response to an appeal of the black community for harsher sentencing. So when people are talking about mass incarceration, that came in response to the demands from the black community to get these drug dealers off the street.
Bob Woodson, thank you so much for joining us. As always, we just love you, adore your love for this country and all those who were truly disenfranchised by bad leadership, bad policies. And I hope we can work together in the future. It's just one of the all-time greats here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. Let's go to Mark in Ohio. A lot of people want to chime in. Hey, Mark, go ahead. Welcome.
Hey, Laura, thanks for having me on the show.
Welcome.
You know, my comment is, you know, nothing, you know, Trump said about Baltimore is racist. He's simply pointing out the fact that these liberal-ran cities by, you know, Cummings, Pelosi, de Blasio and company are in the worst possible shape and living conditions for any American or human being to live. You know, they're using the race card to deflect from the fact that if the constituents in these areas realize that they've been lied to for years and the dream of, you know, economic prosperity is possible, these leaders will lose all support. They need the constituents to feel defeated, dependent, and powerless.
Yeah, I understand. I agree. I agree with you. But I think Woodson, who's been doing this for 50 years in the inner city, his point is one of methodology and tonality. And you get a lot further with folks in areas where you don't live, especially in, you know, you haven't spent a lot of time in Baltimore, as the president has not. You get a lot more with people, I think, by just kind of rolling up your sleeves and supporting groups that do, than making it a personal thing between you and Cummings. And so Bob's point was, go around these failed leaders. Go around them. And then let the people speak for themselves. And as you saw, a lot of these women in Baltimore on the streets, like, This isn't working. What they're doing isn't working. And they're pleading. It's much more powerful to have an African-American woman who lives there day in and day out, who suffers through this, the crime and the underperforming schools, than it is to just send a tweet off and say Elijah Cummings is a fraud.
Help us, because we're helping y'all. Y'all want our votes. Y'all need to help us. Once y'all start helping us, maybe the neighborhood, maybe Baltimore will get better.
No, that was just one. There were many like her. And that's more powerful, I think, than setting off a firestorm of Sharpton and then tweets and then more tweets and then more. Yeah, of course, it's all these cities need, you know, need real work, common sense. But why not talk about the policies that will turn it around? I think that's better. As much as I like, you know, hitting hard and hitting often, not sure what it's going to accomplish. And is this helping reelect Trump? I don't think so. I don't think so. He needs women voters, and he needs women who are smart and, you know, excited about the future of the country. Don't give him a reason not to vote for you. That's my view. And again, I don't think, of course, what he said wasn't racist, but you give people an easy weapon to hit you in the face with or over the head with by just focusing on Cummings. It's Cummings plus leadership going back to the late 40s and Nancy Pelosi's father, who was mayor of Baltimore. So unless you're going to just do a daily tutorial on all the failed leadership of Baltimore, I mean, Cummings is one in a long line of national, local, and state leaders who failed that city. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham podcast. I want to thank all of our great sponsors who make this show possible. And of course, Pluto TV, Genucel, and ADT Home Security. They help provide this podcast free for you every week. So make sure to support them. And I want to remind everybody who's been listening to this podcast about the great skincare products that our friends at Chamonix, they put together with incredible compounds. And one that I just, you guys seem to just love, and I'm so happy about it, is the Genucel's amazing, amazing new jawline treatment. Now, a jawline, your neck, it's kind of sensitive skin. You want the MDL technology, the proprietary base, the brand new treatment that helps get your skin back to looking tighter, healthier, younger looking. Cheryl from Fort Wayne, Indiana loves it. She said she's been using it for a week. She says the results are visible and her jawline looks so much better, even younger. Smiley face. All right. Well, love it. Keep sending us all of these comments and I love to read them and I'll continue to share them with all of you out there. Remember, it's just Genucel.com. That's Genucel.com. You get 100% of your money back. No questions asked if you don't like the results, but you will. I'm telling you. But it's a great deal and just great guarantee. So you order now and you get the Genucel for bags and puffiness, also free with your order. And also the Genucel immediate effects, also free. So there's no time but the present to get the best skin possible with the Genucel line of products. That's Genucel.com and two free gifts and express shipping at Genucel.com. They say home is where the heart is, and the reality is that home is where all of your precious belongings are located. Home is your sanctuary after a hard day's work. Home is a special place where you create memories with your family and your friends. So when you want to protect yourself and your most precious investment, go with the nation's number one smart home security provider, ADT. With ADT Smart Home Security, you'll have a team of professionals monitoring your home 24/7, using the latest innovations to safeguard your property. Visit ADT.com. That's ADT.com. Joining us now is Shelby Steele, esteemed author of so many phenomenal books, filmmaker, and senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He joins us now. Dr. Steele, well, I was just talking to Bob Woodson, who said, and I'd like your view on this, he said, you know, he obviously doesn't think Trump is racist, but his point is that you get a lot further with people by not making the situation personally focused on someone who, for you know, correctly or not, is a beloved leader in the city, and instead focus on what can be done to turn the city around. What are your thoughts?
Well, I always agree with Mr. Woodson. I think that makes a lot of sense. Yes, it's much better to focus on policy. On the other hand, that said, I think we're in a culture war, an extremely important one, and that the terms of that war sort of influence power itself. What Trump said about Baltimore is something that truly needed to be said. I've worked on a film this summer and been to the inner city, spent a lot of time in different cities in the inner city, and this is a profound problem. Not just the shootings and so forth that go on, but the utter human despair is just remarkable. And Trump, in that sense, is, you know, because in America we're always deferential toward blacks, toward poverty, and we in other words imprison ourselves in a kind of politeness. Trump does not do that. He is not deferential. He does not have white guilt. What he does have is very difficult truths that need to be said, need to be dealt with. And of course, on the other hand, Bob is absolutely right. It shouldn't put people off, but it does put people off, and it does give people the opportunity to dismiss what he says. On the other hand, I think one of the reasons he was elected is that he's not deferential. You can trust that he means what he says. And in this case, I think I think he's right. These inner cities are horrible,
disgraceful,
horrible, and corrupt, and so forth.
And you Shelby, know, I think that when you look at going all the way back to like Nancy Pelosi's father, I'm only mentioning him because this goes back to the 40s, really. This
sure
leadership. He was, I think, the 39th mayor of Baltimore, Thomas D'Alessandro. And he was another example of failed liberal leadership in a city that used to have 1 million people, now has 600,000 people. That right. fact in and of itself is just a stunner.
Right. Yeah, I spent some time in St. Louis this summer, and St. Louis used to have close to 1 million people that now has 235,000.
Oh, my God.
3/4 of it's gone. So this is really, again, I think it, in many ways it comes out of our history. We have been, America has been shamed by its history. We have to be honest about that. And that's caused it to in a sense, become redemptive and we've sort of changed our idea of what virtue is. And it has to do with being deferential toward victims of the past. And that's sort of now our cultural norm, and it's choking us to death. You can't name problems if you're going to be deferential all the time. If you're going to be apologetic, shy about it. These inner cities are just blighted. They're just human suffering, generation after generation, and of course they have 3 or 4 generations to everyone else's one. And so the problem multiplies. The government supports it, feeds it. Cummings is a part of the problem. He facilitates all of this. Same in Chicago, same in Detroit, same in New Orleans, so forth. So until we get to a place where we're able to get past, particularly white America, let me be frank about it. White America is so terrorized of being seen as racist, they act guilty. They act guiltily even when they're not guilty. And that becomes something that blacks then see as their power. White guilt equals black power. And people like Cummings have survived on that for forever. Well, that's the problem here. That's the dynamic. Until we break that dynamic, we can't go in and talk about the problem. We can't talk about teenage pregnancy. We can't talk about the absolute disappearance of marriage and family. The horror chambers that are the public schools. We can't get to those things because it's impolite. And in this sense, I guess I have to say that Trump's impoliteness is called for.
Yeah, and I think, again, they get away with it. And no more so than Al Sharpton, who, of course, like a bad cold, just keeps coming back. Let's listen.
Little did I know that Mr. Trump was going to, on the eve of this, attack the congressman from this city. And not only the congressmen, but the people of this city, in the most bigoted and racist way. He attacks everybody. He has a particular venom for blacks and people of color. George Wallace ran in 68. George Wallace didn't do some of the things that in the campaign.
Right.
George Wallace was a terrible guy, stood in the door of the University of Alabama. But in the campaign, he tried to dress it up more than what we're seeing. And it's a consistent pattern and a deliberate political strategy that would make George Wallace blush what this president is doing.
And that was just part of the venom he spewed, but basically saying that the president is just trying to rile up his base and using these, racial dog whistles to get people excited about voting for him. I mean, that's just, and the cable television, as I told Bob, they just eat it up year after year.
Right. Well, Sharpton is out there doing what he always does. He wants black Americans to have an identity that is grounded in their victimization. He wants black Americans to think of themselves as victims of America. That's how he gets paid off. That's how he continues to. So a moment like this, he's going to just jump on it and try to rub it in Trump's face. But it's just the same old Al. Use of victimization as power. The tragedy there, of course, is that once you think of yourself as a victim, same thing is true with reparations. The same thing, once you think of yourself that way, you're pretty much finished. You don't see opportunity anymore. You see the lack of it. You see a world that is unfriendly to you. And all you have left then is your meager little anger. And that's where Sharpton is at this point. Everything that came out of the 60s in terms of dealing with inner-city poverty, everything failed. Not some of it. Everything failed. Well, that really points to this underlying symbiotic relationship in America between blacks and whites that's gone on since before the Mayflower, where each race constantly looks for leverage with the other race. Well, Sharpton is happy when he hears the president say that because it gives him leverage. He can say, see, even the president of the United States is racist. That's why you should give me things. Pay my taxes, for example. But it's a hustle that comes out of this underlying relationship. And until we really address that, until whites, for example, become confident enough in their own lack of racism that they stand up once again and reject this idea that we have to just defer. We basically have an affirmative action culture where we defer, we offer deference to former victims as a way, I guess, of making ourselves legitimate. Well, it's a dead end street, but boy, we keep clinging to it and playing it out in little incidents like this.
We're talking to Shelby Steele here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. The 2020 Democrats are kind of repeating a lot of these same talking points on race.
I think that what Donald Trump has done over the past couple of days is despicable, and the reason he has done this is that Trump is trying to distract from the fact that his is a failed presidency. And Donald Trump hopes that if he can just throw some racism, really ugly stuff, that everyone will pay attention to that instead of paying attention to what a failure he is.
Hmm. A lot of people saying she could overtake Biden and Kamala Harris and become the Democrat nominee, meaning we'd get the same thing we got under Obama, which is no progress on race relations. It actually got worse under Obama.
That's absolutely right. It would be just the same old symbiotic relationship where she's now stealing the thunder of black suffering. She's saying, I'm going to redeem us from that, and that's why you should vote for me, and that's why you should give me power and so forth. So everybody exploits poor blacks. They're like just a deep well of power, and it certainly worked for Obama. He did get elected. Maybe it'll help her as well. I hope not, but because my sense is that America's beginning to move beyond this. People see that this is a corruption, that there isn't really very much victimization out here anymore. They kind of long for it. And reparation just seems to me is just one of the ways that they try to keep the issue alive and use it as leverage against whites and in order to be elected and find and build power for themselves.
Bob pointed out that in Florida, Trump, only won by a razor-thin margin of overall votes, and that 100,000 of Trump's votes came from single black women living in pretty poor conditions. That's right. Pretty interesting. I mean, it seems like a small number overall, but that made a difference for Trump. I mean, should be a lot more. But I think he wants to give people a lifeline out of this and extend the what do you have to lose? Let's try new solutions. But I think he's got to start talking about the solutions now.
I would agree with you there. He really does. Maybe he will. I don't know. But I like the fact in the sense that there's a paradigm here. It's terrible. It's corrupt. He's jarring that paradigm. He's saying it's inauthentic. It's not producing anything. It is a new form of oppression. Blacks now suffer from liberalism as their great oppressor. Where racism once was, now it is literally liberalism that dehumanizes them, that keeps them locked in patterns of self-defeat and so forth. He's jarring that. He's shaking it up. That's a value. Now you're absolutely right. He has to come up with a more comprehensive statement that might move the whole culture in a new direction where race is concerned. And he hasn't done that yet.
It really is interesting and depressing. I was depressed yesterday, Shelby, because it seemed like I was back where I was at Dartmouth all those years ago, where it was the same dynamic. Like if you criticized affirmative action, you were racist. If you criticized African American studies and all the studies, which we thought were, Dinesh and I were doing all these articles on how the studies were, and I think Dinesh wrote, were ghettoizing various groups of who deserve better, groups of Americans. And you know, he's an immigrant, you know, very dark skinned Indian who came here with nothing in high school and then ended up becoming a huge success, but. You know, he couldn't understand it because he's like, I come from India and that's where real discrimination takes place. And he was absolutely stunned at how white people were so cowed by all these bogus charges of racism. I mean, not that there's not racism, there is racism, but it was used as a weapon all those years ago in the 1980s at Dartmouth.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because my sense is I agree with Dinesh. My sense is that the problem today is in white America. If white America has been acculturated over the last 60 years to accommodate, to be deferential, to say, okay, I don't really agree with affirmative action, but let's go along with it. It's kept going, deferring, going along with that to the point where we've now wiped out our education system in America, all the way through the college level at this point. Through deference, constantly deferring, constantly giving in to this terror of being seen as racist. And until whites stand up and begin to acknowledge that the terror they feel, and say, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of feeling it. I'm not racist. Call me that all you want. The moment that begins to happen, the world will change. Many blacks will be happy to see that kind of thing because it treats them as human beings rather than as victims, but we haven't. Trump is on the side of the good in that sense. He's far from perfect, but he's on the side of the good in that sense. He's shaking up that paradigm.
I agree. I think as much as people, you know, don't like his style, I can say this from all the time I've spent with him over the last 20 years, and I've known him for a long time. He's truly just absolutely flummoxed that we're still in this same feedback loop on the inner city. And the same solutions are being tried They didn't work the first 20 times you did them, so they're probably not going to work now. And he, for the life of him, he's like, why are we still doing the same stuff? It doesn't work. Let's do something else. And that's kind of a simple way of looking at it, but he's truly outraged by that, and he's very frustrated. Very frustrated. And he wants there to be real positive change. He really, truly does.
I bet he does. I mean, I think he's I'm happy to hear that. That frustration is where maybe change will come. If he validates it as the president of the United States and says, you can believe in America without being a racist, that's a message that blacks want to hear, that everybody wants to hear. That's great leadership. And I think Trump has that. He has this sort of atavistic vision of America as a great, great nation. And racial reform ought to be done in the context of that greatness.
Mm-hmm.
Where we don't just say, oh, change your habits and do this. You say to Americans, listen, we have moved beyond racism. We must discipline ourselves to never allow it to recur again. And we must, therefore, ask of minorities that they move themselves forward, as all Americans do, and that we give nothing to minorities that we don't give to anyone else, that we just break that distinction down. Well, that's... I'm glad to hear that, because I wondered if he had a sort of personal
connection. He's so enraged. Oh yeah, no, he sits there and he's like, how is this still happening? And he's really impatient. Like, he's impatient for change. Obama was a very powerful orator in his own way, and he could give a great speech, and he had a lot of friends and a lot of, you know, high places in the entertainment industry, and they empathized, and not a darn thing was done. No change. At least Ben Carson's out there trying to open up these very few public housing slots that do exist to deserving American citizens instead of giving them to illegal immigrants, which is what we've been doing for a long time. So I think that there's all sorts of ways that Trump can appeal to a diverse group of low-income Americans by saying, look, the other people want to use kids as political talking points at the border. I think your kids deserve better right here at home. And I think he should keep saying that. And I'll let you close it out.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that entirely. I'm glad to hear that he has that kind of a passion. That I think will make his presidency great. You know, this sounds really extravagant, and people may chuckle, but there is something, you know, that's Churchillian about Donald Trump, in that he has a vision of America that, you know, is beyond just reason. It has to do with the heart, with passion. And, you know, that's very attractive. We've never sort of relied on that kind of thing to overcome domestic problems, race, and so forth. I think that's the way to go. And that Trump has sort of inadvertently maybe pointed that out. We're great enough to deal with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to keep deferring to it and coming up with artificial solutions and so forth. We can inner city and say, you people be great Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That's the goal. The American dream is yours. Everything ought to be focused on that.
Yeah, and I think that what, again, is fascinating is how they are trying to keep him out of going into the inner city, as they did in 2016 with the riots in San Jose and Oakland. And then in Chicago, remember, he was going there and they basically threatened violence and the campaign canceled the event. They want to keep him out of the inner city because I think they know there are a lot of people who maybe they know him from pop culture and they see him as president. And they think it's kind of unique and he's kind of bold and brash. And that's attractive to a lot of people.
It
and
sure
so I think
is.
They want to cordon him off from those that inner city, Shelby.
Yeah, that's I don't blame him. You know, because he has charisma.
Mm-hmm.
He's the things that worry other people don't worry Black, the impoliteness that he shows. People forgive that if with the leader they feel really sees them as they are as human beings, and I think Trump does. Mm-hmm.
Shelby Steele, it's always great to talk to you here on the Laura Ingraham podcast. We've got to get you on TV. Thank you so much for your thoughts. Such an important conversation we're having, and Trump ignited it. You know, whatever you think of that original tweets over the weekend, he ignited it. Frank in Maryland. Frank, welcome.
Hey, hi, how are you, Laura? I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
Laura, I just want to stop the racist talk. I mean, you can't have a conversation with anybody if all they're doing is saying, oh, you're a racist because I disagree with you. Can we have a clear conversation about what's happening in this country?
I agree. I think it's used as a way to stop debate. It's used as a way to shut debate down and shield people from accountability. So you don't have to be accountable if you're protected by false charges of racism against you. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham podcast. I want to thank all of our sponsors. Genucel, Pluto TV, ADT Home Security, all fabulous. Let's go to Dan in Maryland. Dan, welcome.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you.
I'm so glad the president brought this up. I'm a lifelong resident of Baltimore area, and Baltimore is a disaster. I don't think there's anything racist in any way, shape, or form what the president said. I was on Twitter this weekend, and Baltimore was all the rage on Twitter, thank goodness, finally. This, our cities are have been run by Democrats forever. The last Republican elected to Baltimore City Council was 1947. Baltimore had a higher income than the national average in the 1950s, and now it's below average. The city schools are a disaster. The last mayor was resigned in amid a scandal. The mayor before that said during the Freddie Gray riots, okay, let them riot.
Yeah, we talked
about
that.
And the mayor before that resigned because she was stealing gift cards meant for the poor.
No, deep corruption. It's the corruption runs deep, and it hurts the kids. I mean, they care about the kids. They saw the kids at the border, kids in cages, kids separated. There are a lot of kids separated from their families because the families are gone, dead. Fathers, brothers in Baltimore. You don't have to go to the border to see the ultimate in family separation. So we got a lot of big, big problems right here at home. We've been talking about this for years. The use of race as a cudgel merely shuts down debate and true introspection about what works, what is a time-tested strategy for success versus what has failed for decades. I forgot that Pelosi's brother was also mayor. The D'Alessandros were father was mayor and her brother was mayor in the 1970s, early 1970s. I'm not laying it all at their feet, but it's an interesting factoid. Lots of problems in that city. And they predated Trump by about 60 years. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham podcast. Remember, America now and forever. We'll see you next time.